four of the Colorado Court of Appeals. Have counsel received our statement of written instructions?
Yes, sir.
Do you have any questions? For those of the spectators, if you have any cell phones or similar devices, would you please turn them off so that the attorneys are not interrupted in their argument? With that, we're ready to proceed in our first case, Bates versus Henneberry.
Good morning, Your Honor. Eric Sullivan. I'd like to introduce Mr. Lance McKinley, associate of the firm, who will give the argument for LMA Bates.
Very good.
Good morning. May it please the court. 5 years ago, the appellant LMA Bates settled and funded an irrevocable trust for the benefit of her son and his family. She understood at that time she was making a gift, which, if she applied for Medicaid, would trigger a penalty period. She then waited for this penalty period to pass before she applied. She played by the rules. Upon applying for Medicaid, she was denied based on an unreasonable interpretation of the trust in question in this case.
Let's assume, and I'm not asking you to concede any points, but let's just assume we conclude that the Medicaid Act sections you rely on are not actionable under 1983 and that your state law claim is untimely. Do we then get to the correctness of the interpretation of the trust instrument?
Your Honor, if...
In other words, is that in any sense a separate claim, or is it necessarily subsidiary either to your administrative review claim or your 1983 claims?
Your Honor, we see the claims as independent of each other. We see the claim, the civil rights claim, as independent from the administrative, the judicial review claim.
Okay, but is the alleged incorrectness of the trust interpretation a separate claim, or is it part of 1983, or is it part of the administrative review?
Your Honor, it can be part of either.
This is not separate and apart from either.
Yes, Your Honor, it's not.
Thank you.
Ms. Bates is before the court this morning, to ask the court to recognize that she does have an individual right to enforce those sections of the Medicaid statute that require a reasonable interpretation of Medicaid applicants' trust. She's also before the court to ask it recognize that the department's interpretation of the trust was not reasonable. And finally, with respect to the administrative appeal, she's before the court to state that by filing a request for reconsideration and having the agency in turn ask for briefs and itself file a brief, that extended or reset the deadline to file for judicial review. With respect to the individual enforceability, Your Honor, this, of course, is brought under Section 1983 to enforce the relevant statutes, with the relevant sections within the Medicaid statute, first one being a reasonable standard that the department must review a Medicaid applicant's resources in a reasonable manner, 1396A.17. We believe that must be read in par materia with the any circumstances test, which itself focuses on analysis specifically of trusts. The reasonableness section creates an overarching standard for analyzing any assets brought to the table by the Medicaid applicant, and underneath that overarching standard is the any circumstances test. Now, this court has applied the test set forth by the United States Supreme Court before in the case of Moniz v. Reinertsen, as far as individual enforceability. The three-prong test set forth in those cases, really it's the first prong of the test, which asks, do these statutes contain rights-creating language? Do they have an unmistakable focus on the benefited class? We believe they do. The reasonableness statute has produced divergent opinion in courts across the country. For those courts that believe and found they were individually enforceable, they found that the focus is on individual eligibility. They found that the reasonableness standard is intended to provide a standard upon which individual applicants can rely in determination of their benefit eligibility by state officials. the focus is on the individual applicant, his or her individual application. With respect to the any circumstances test, which asks, are there any circumstances under which the trust would make a distribution to the applicant, there isn't really a strong case on either side from the research that has found for or against individual enforceability. However, reading these sections in pari materia, we would argue that any circumstances, just like any test under the Medicaid statute for whether it's a resource to the individual, has to be applied reasonably. And as we stated in the briefs, the any circumstances test does identify the individual several times and seems to focus directly on the individual's eligibility. Both of these sections do require the department to act, yes, but the fact is that it's required to act in a way that treats the individual reasonably. And in fact, we would argue any case in which a section of the Medicaid statute has been found individually enforceable does require the department to act. The department has to provide something, has to treat the applicant in a certain way, and that has to be a reasonable way. Turning to the violation of the sections, focusing on what the department argued both at the administrative level and the judicial review, we do not think the arguments are reasonable. The department contended that the trust could make a loan to Ms. Bates because of a general loan provision in section 7.11. However, as the ALJ and the Denver Probate Court found, the basic longstanding principle of trust interpretation provides that that specific provisions prevail over the general provisions. And in this case, section 3.02 states in part, no payment or distribution shall be made by my trustee for the discharge of any of my legal obligations or otherwise for my monetary benefit. We believe, Your Honor, that this is an unreasonable argument, therefore, to treat a generic loan provision as applying to the settlor of the trust when an earlier provision explicitly said that the purpose of the trust is not to benefit the settlor. The department's other main arguments concerned section 6.16 involving early termination of the trust if it's uneconomical. While Ms. Bates funded the trust with roughly $115,000, I believe her son funded even further, so I don't see the trust becoming economical anytime soon. The department tagged onto that argument this idea that because Les Bates, Ms. Bates' son, was her power of attorney and the primary beneficiary of the trust, that if the trust terminated and he received the money, that he could then provide her the funds via the power of attorney. This is an argument we find absurd and again, it's unreasonable. With respect to the probate court, the trustees turned to the probate court to clarify their responsibilities. The department stating the trustees can make loans to the settlor and potentially terminate the trust and distribute to her indirectly. And the probate court sided with the administrative law judge and applied these longstanding principles that have let us interpret trust in a consistent way over long periods of time. Because of the unreasonableness of these interpretations, we assert that they are not entitled to deference. The validity of the reasoning has been found wanting by two judicial officers.
Why is 7.11 not as specific as the other provisions? 7.11 of the trust instrument says, my trustee may make secured or unsecured loans to any person, including a beneficiary, for any term or payment payable on demand, with or without interest. Isn't that pretty specific about making loans? It gives him the authority to make loans?
It does give him the authority, Your Honor, but with respect to Ms. Bates, she is explicitly excluded in an earlier section that's more specific to her. The focus is on her. Your Honor, finally, with request to the request for reconsideration, the Department, of course, asserts that Ms. Bates didn't bring her judicial review case in time. We would assert, however, that after she filed a request for consideration, she received a request for briefs from the department, in which the department also participated. The department briefed the case as well. this left Ms. Bates in a strange position, sort of a glitch in the appellate process. She could respond to the request for reconsideration or brief it as requested and let the department make another final agency decision, or she could take the case on up to judicial review to the district court and divest the department, the agency, of the ability to rule on the request for reconsideration.
Well, didn't she have a third alternative to ask in her motion for reconsideration that the department suspend the effective date of its deposition, which is the procedure suggested in the Bethesda Foundation case?
Yes, she did. She did have that option, Your Honor.
She did not exercise that option.
She did not exercise that option. To her, it was sort of an implied understanding. Both sides are responding to the request for reconsideration. It appeared that there was an implied understanding that the judicial review, the effective date, would be moved out once again after the request for reconsideration was disposed of in either direction.
Who made a request for reconsideration?
Ms. Bates did, Your Honor.
I thought you said earlier the department requested that she seek reconsideration. It notified her that she could seek reconsideration in one paragraph of its order, and then the next paragraph said, but the 30-day time limit still applies. Isn't that a fair reading of the final agency decision?
Yes, Your Honor. However, after the request was filed, the department then asked for briefs.
From the other side?
From Ms. Bates.
But yes. That was still within the 30-day time period, and you could have asked for the stipulation to extend the effective date.
Yes, that is true, Your Honor.
Are you arguing that it's in a form of estoppel, that the agency is estopped by the notices that it sent?
Your Honor, I wouldn't go that far. I would assert that it was an implied understanding between the parties, unfortunately never made explicit, that this request for reconsideration would have the chance to be fully examined and ruled upon by the department.
But an implied understanding that's inconsistent with the statute that the legislature passed that establishes our jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor, but again, by taking the case up on judicial review, then the request for reconsideration is basically a hollow gesture. It's not of much use.
Unless you stipulate to defer the effective date.
Yes, Your Honor.
And did you know about the Bethesda case? Well, it doesn't matter. The Bethesda case had been decided, so it was out there for you to follow.
Yes, Your Honor, we were aware of that. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve any remaining time for rebuttal.
You have about 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Elisa Campbell, registration number 30632, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Colorado, and I represent the Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing. I first want to address the fact that Ms. Bates' attorney spent a fair amount of time talking about the interpretation of this trust, and I want to clarify that the district court never got to that piece of it. The district court found that the two federal statutes at issue here from the Medicaid Act do not contain the rights-creating language identified by the Supreme Court in Gonzaga versus Doe as necessary to support a 1983 cause of action. So, Your Honors, the record supports the district court's decision in this case in favor of the department because of the rights-creating language issue, and also because her complaint for judicial review was filed beyond the 30-day deadline, which is required by the Administrative Procedures Act. So, unless the court has any immediate questions, I'd like to address Ms. Bates' arguments in the following order. First, the rights-creating language issue, and then the judicial review deadline issue. The Supreme Court in Gonzaga versus Doe clarified and narrowed the first prong of the blessing three-part test for when a federal statute supports a 1983 cause of action. And the Gonzaga court found that there must be more than just the plaintiff falling within the general zone of interest that the statute was designed to protect. The key language out of the Gonzaga case was the statute must be phrased in terms of the individual. There must be an unmistakable focus on the benefited class. The statute must clearly impart an entitlement. And the bottom line is, it must unambiguously confer a right on the individual. And the Gonzaga court gave a couple of examples of federal statutes that do contain rights-creating language, Title VI from the Civil Rights Act and Title IX from the Education Act. And both of those statutes, the language in those statutes begins, "No person shall be subjected to discrimination." So clearly, the focus is on the individual, no person, and the entitlement or the right is shall be subjected to discrimination. And those two statutes can be distinguished from the two statutes at issue here, the Treatment of Trust Statute from the Medicaid Act and the State Plan Requirements Statute. First, the Treatment of Trust Statute, while it's true it does contain the word individual, I believe two or three times, the focus is not on the individual in that statute. It's an instruction to the state of what they must look at when they're deciding whether or not an irrevocable trust contains accountable resource. If payment or benefit can go to the individual, then state, you must count that as accountable resource. So again, the focus isn't on the individual. Rather, it's language that speaks to the state, imposes a duty on the state, or instructions to the state, rather, on how to treat trusts. The second statute from the state plan requirements, which is 1396A, subsection A17, that is a requirement, again, for the state of, their state plan must include reasonable standards for determining eligibility. One thing notable about that statute is that it doesn't contain the words individual or persons anywhere. And under Gonzaga, that's a fatal error. Ms. Bates did cite six cases that held subsection A17 does create a private right of action under 1983. However, notably, four of those cases are pre-Gonzaga. Only two of them are post-Gonzaga. And those two post-Gonzaga cases, the first one, Carr versus Holsinger, really did only a blessing type analysis where it said the plaintiffs would be benefited by this statute. And with Gonzaga, and really with blessing as well, it's not whether there is a benefit, it's whether there is a right that is conferred. The other post-Gonzaga case cited by Ms. Bates was the Mendez case, and it really didn't do any sort of rights creating language analysis at all. On the other hand, the department cited five cases that said subsection A17 does not create a right of action under section 1983, and all of those are post Gonzaga cases. And the analysis they did, notably, the District Court of Colorado in the Mundell case said this is not phrased in terms of the individual. The District Court of Kansas in Sanders said this subsection only imposes a duty on the state. The Langford case out of the Eighth Circuit mentioned that it's not phrased in terms of the individuals, which again is fatal under the Gonzaga analysis. And the Langford case also conceded that these are only broad general goals that a state has discretion in implementing. And the Ninth Circuit in the Watson versus Weeks case stated the key language in this statute is not focused on the individual and it does not confer an individual right. On the judicial review deadline issue, this court is absolutely right. Ms. Bates did have another option rather than filing in district court before she got an answer on her motion for reconsideration. She could have asked the Office of Appeals to postpone or suspend the effective date. That is the holding in the Bethesda case out of the Colorado Supreme Court. And the Administrative Procedures Act in Colorado case law is clear that you have 30 days to file your complaint for judicial review, whether or not a motion for reconsideration is filed, unless that motion is required by statute for a specific agency, which was not the case here. The order denying the motion for reconsideration did not revive this deadline. There's nothing in case law or no legal authority out there that says that would revive that deadline. This issue,
even though it states the appellant may commence an action for judicial review of the final agency decision, doesn't that kind of lull her into thinking that I have the right to go to court now?
I disagree, Your Honor. I think the case law out there is very clear that this deadline is not told by the filing of a motion for reconsideration. And the order from the Office of Appeals on that motion restated, and you can file a complaint for judicial review within 30 days of the effective date of the final agency decision. So she can do that calculation.
Well, the question is, when is the final agency decision? Is it the first one or the one issued after the motion for reconsideration?
No, Your Honor, it is the pleading that came out first that it was entitled Final Agency Decision. I think the order on the motion for reconsideration was clear when it said you can file for judicial review within 30 days of the effective date of the final agency decision.
Well, let's hypothetically say the final agency decision changed something from the original decision. Are you saying, and that comes out more than 30 days after the original decision, are you saying she has a dissatisfied claimant would have no ability to challenge that?
I'm sorry, you're saying if the order on the motion for reconsideration
changed something? On reconsideration, they changed something from the earlier decision, and that's what the person also wants to appeal. Are you saying they'd be barred from appealing that because the 30-day period had run, and that's not a final agency decision, or is that a supplement to the final agency decision?
My opinion would be that would be a supplemental, a different issue. I can't imagine how the order on a motion for reconsideration would change the final agency decision, but if it did, that would be separate. She still needs to appeal the final agency decision that came out on September 4th, I believe.
So there'd have to be two different notices of appeal filed? I mean, I understand in this case it didn't happen, but it's theoretical what you're...
I see what you're saying, and I see them as two different subjects. She's filing a motion for reconsideration of the final agency decision. So if there's something in the order on the motion for reconsideration that she's dissatisfied with, then she has remedies to appeal that at the district court. But she also needs to appeal the final agency decision in a timely manner. Unless the court has further questions for the reasons stated in the answer brief and argued here this morning, I would ask that this court affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would just reinforce the with the judicial review issue. The lack of finality, the deadline to bring an action for judicial review on the initial final agency decision, I believe is October 8. The agency ruled denying the request for reconsideration on October 12. So again, Ms. Bates is sort of left in limbo here as to whether she takes jurisdiction away from the agency and moves up to the next level, or hopes that a request for reconsideration, fully briefed, might make some headway as far as a reversal of the final agency decision. Your Honor, with respect to individual enforceability, again, with the any circumstances test, there is no case out there that's really gone either way. We could point out, however, that the case of Lewis v. Rendell, which was out of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, found that the disability trust statute, which is also under 1396 PD, was individually enforceable. In that case, I believe the state of Pennsylvania was trying to enforce provisions, requirements on disability trusts that went above and beyond the requirements in the federal statute. And because, again, the focus of that statute is eligibility of the individual, that court found that they could enforce the provisions of the disability trust statute and required that the state could not exceed them. Your Honor, in closing, I just want to say again, Ms. Bates had a very human desire to pass on some of her estate to her loved ones. This is not uncommon. She understood that if she needed Medicaid, this would trigger a penalty period, and she duly waited out that penalty period. She played by the rules. In response, when she presented this trust that she created for her son to the department came back with a set of very unreasonable interpretations of the trust and denied her eligibility. We ask the court recognize she has the right to require them to be reasonable in interpreting the trust. and that the right was violated. So we ask as a matter of law that the trust was never a resource to her. Thank you, Your Honor. I have nothing further.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel.